Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We live in a time when many childhood diseases have been virtually eradicated through the development and distribution of vaccines. That means today, many people have no concept of the fear parents faced and the dangers their children confronted in the days before those vaccines. And that has led to vaccine reluctance and skepticism, resulting in the reappearance of diseases we thought we had conquered long ago. And that makes this a good time to remember what it was like in the period before those vaccines. And folks in Hickory do. In May of 1944, as World War II raged and Allies were preparing to land on the beaches of Normandy, a child in Catawba County contracted polio. Often referred to then as infantile paralysis, it wasn't fully understood. What people did know was that it usually struck children suddenly in the warmer months, but they weren't quite sure of how it was transmitted. In just a few weeks, more than 24 children were stricken with this virus, and soon hospitals in Charlotte and Gastonia were filled with polio patients. That left the community in Hickory with no place to turn to fight a virus that was as unpredictable as it was uncontrollable. But Hickory did something remarkable. In just over 2 days, they built a makeshift hospital to treat local patients. And over the course of 9 months, they treated more than 450 children. It became known as the Miracle of Hickory. And we have come to Hickory to remember that achievement. We're at the Belk Centrum Auditorium on the campus at Lenoir Ryan University. And in addition to our live audience, we have assembled a great panel to talk about all of this. Richard Eller has been on this program several times in the past. He's a professor of history at Catawba Valley Community College, co-author of a book called Polio, Pitchforks and Perseverance. He is also one of the people responsible for a documentary on this topic, and a graduate of Lenoir Ryan University. Welcome back.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Go Bears.
Kimberly Price is Associate Professor of Public Health and Director of the Master of Public Health Program right here at Lenoir Ryan University. Good evening to you.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
And Dan Mowry is with us. Dan is a miracle of history survivor. I think you contracted polio when you were what, 9 years old?
9 years old.
Which makes you 12 now, right?
90. Almost 91.
Almost 90. Well, thank you all for being here. Kimberly, I'm going to start with you because there are people listening to us in Charlotte and perhaps people listening to us in Hickory who know nothing at all about this. The older people do, obviously, maybe, but not the younger people. And many people, because of the things I just said, are not at all familiar with polio.
Right.
So tell us about polio, Kimberly. Remind us of how it affects people.
Yes, thank you again for having me this evening. And polio is something that usually you think of like black and white photos or seeing something in a history book. But I'm also here to tell you that polio is still an issue that we're dealing with today in this world. Maybe not locally in the United States, but it is definitely something that we're seeing across the globe. So we haven't finished the fight yet. We're almost there, but we have not finished the fight yet. But poliomyelitis is the disease that is caused by the polio virus. And although I'm not a clinician, I'm not an expert in the area of polio, I do have the opportunity to teach our students here about epidemiology and the distribution of diseases, including infectious diseases that have been addressed with vaccines and have had outbreaks in the United States. And I'm very proud of our students who have gone on to work at our local health departments here in Catawba County and Buncombe County, and as well as Mecklenburg and Gastonia. But polio is a disease that is an enterovirus. So it's a virus that people get orally, so it can be transmitted person to person, and it can be from oral to oral or fecal to oral. A lot of times you see it in children. You think of when children are in diapers and you're changing diapers, if there's a virus that is in their fecal matter and your hands are not washed properly, you could go on to touch a toy and the toy could enter the child's mouth and the virus can enter the system yeah. through the throat down into the intestines where the virus can multiply. And as it's multiplying and replicating, it can then get to the central nervous system. And once it gets to the spinal cord, you know, the spinal cord has nerves that leave the spinal cord to go to innervate the muscles. So if there's a virus that damages those nerves, then there's going to be paralysis for the muscles that are affected.
And a lot of what you just said, people back in 1944 didn't know anything
right.
about it. It's the kind of virus, evidently, as I read yesterday, you can have it. It can be hiding in plain sight. You can contract it, and days will go by before any.
Even weeks.
Yeah.
Most people are asymptomatic when they contract the virus. About 90% of the people are asymptomatic. But 1 in 200 people who contract a virus will go on to have this paralysis.
President Franklin Roosevelt they think he was a polio victim. Some people say that he may have suffered from another disease, Guillain-Barré syndrome, but at the time they called it polio, and he contracted it at the age of 39. But most of the people who contracted polio were children.
Yes.
Why?
Well, with children, again, their susceptibility is because of the way it's transmitted. So if you're an adult, it might be possible if you're like swimming at someplace in a facility that you could be in contact with fecal matter that is holding the virus, or you are encountering people who may have the virus and they might not know it. Because again, 90% of people who contract it, there are no signs. It's asymptomatic. So you might not even realize that you have the virus because you didn't realize that you could get it just from like speaking to someone and there are air droplets that might enter your system as well.
It affects people differently, as I understand it. I mean, you talked about how it's transmitted and how it goes through your spinal cord and weakens muscles. Mm-hmm. Some children could not walk after it was after they contracted it. Franklin Roosevelt was paralyzed from the waist down. Other children couldn't breathe. They had to be in iron lungs, these enormous contraptions that look like great big tubes that you lie on your back in 24/7, and it breathes for you.
Yes.
Dan, you contracted this when you were 9 years old. I don't know how much you remember of what it was like as that disease took over your body. Do you remember what the sequence of events was?
Well, actually, we had gone to Carolina Beach for our annual beach weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way down to the beach, we picked up my sister who was working in the shipyard. And she said, roll up the windows, there's polio in that house over there. And so everybody rolled up the windows and we went down and I got a little sick while we were at the beach and my younger relatives were playing around on the bed with me and nobody was really paying much attention to it. And
what does that mean, you got a little sick? What did that feel like?
Well, it was just like having the flu. I mean,
okay.
We didn't think about it as polio at all. And we got home, went to the doctor. He did a spinal tap and said I had polio. My mother tried to take care of me for about a week, and it really was over what she could do, and she brought me to Hickory. And Hickory was amazing. And she, because there was nobody else at home, came up and took a room and worked in the hospital.
So how badly were you affected as a child? Have you recovered?
As a child, I really wasn't affected that badly. I mean, I could walk. It was mostly in my lower left foot and leg. Uh-huh. They mostly were trying to keep me still.
And has that condition progressed? Has it regressed? Has it gotten better over time?
Well, after spending about 8 months here, I went home and went to school for about 7 months, and my mother took me down to Georgia to the hospital down there, and I had 5 operations on my left foot.
Wow.
And so I walked with a normal gait most of my life, and really was not affected by it physically over time.
I want to talk about your experience in Hickory a little bit later on in the program. Richard Eller is with us. He's the historian on the panel, and I want to bring him into this because polio was very scary at the time and pretty prevalent prior to the Salk vaccine coming out, which we will also talk about. We knew far less about that and other things back then than we do today, even how it was spread. And he just mentioned that when you passed a polio house, you were told to roll up the car windows, and that was the case in Hickory. People were told to roll up the windows when they passed through the town, and even the trains when they passed through the towns, they were advised to roll down the windows in trains because they might catch polio. I don't know if you could catch polio that way, but that's what they advised. The first case, Richard, in Hickory, presented, I understand, on May 5th, 1944. Do we know where it came from, how it originated, or even how it began to spread?
Not really. It came one case at a time early on, and then by the 1st of June, you started seeing multiple cases. And really, Hickory wasn't the hotbed of it. There were, at one point, only like 6 cases from Hickory.
Right.
But Hickory was in the regional center of an area and where it was breaking out all over the place. And so from that one case, then you started getting more. But as far as how that first person, Linda Kaiser, got it, I've never found anything conclusively that explains that. Because it's also weird in the way it happens. There was a kid, Harry Sullivan, up in the mountains, up close to where Tennessee, North Carolina, and Virginia meet. He was out swimming in a dammed up pond, and he got it. And he was by himself. So there's all these different ways in which people get it. There's kids and families that get it, and the other kids and the families don't.
When COVID hit, we had these mandatory shutdowns of business and gathering spots, and it went on for a good part of a year, and it became very quickly controversial and very quickly political. And the same thing kind of happened in Hickory. They closed movie theaters, they closed schools, they were closing swimming pools. And I remember this as a kid, that we sometimes in the summertime they would close swimming pools to try to prevent the spread of polio. Were those closures here mandatory or were they voluntary, Richard?
They were mandatory, yeah.
And what was the pushback like then?
I think because there was such fear of polio that most people went along willingly. Because in Charlotte, it was they raised the age to 16 of kids who couldn't gather. In Hickory, when in the early part of June, and it was 3 health professionals that made this decision in the community, followed along. But when they made that decision, it was for kids 12 and under. Couldn't go to the movie theater, couldn't go to the park, the swimming pools were closed. And so at that point, or not too long after, the community tried to come up with ways in which they accommodated the kids, like Sunday morning Sunday schools on the radio.
We are talking about the miracle of Hickory. We'll talk more about why it's referred to as the miracle of Hickory when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks from Lenoir Ryan University and the Belk Centrum Auditorium.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, WFHE in Hickory, and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Richard Eller. He's a professor of history I think at one point you were the historian in residence with the Historical Association of Catawba County.
That's correct.
And the co-author of Polio, Pitchforks, and Perseverance. He's here because we're in Hickory to talk about the miracle of Hickory. He's here along with Kimberly Price, professor of public health at Lenora Ryan University, and Dan Maurer, a survivor of the miracle of Hickory, which was the spread of polio in the Hickory area in 1944 and the remarkable construction of a hospital in 2 days to service the growing number of patients. This was during World War II, when Americans were already making incredible sacrifices for the war effort. And because of that, I'm going to ask you, was there a sense that we were all in this together already, and this was just an extension of that? And have we lost that spirit, Richard?
Well, I think to some degree we have, yes, because people were in Hickory already doing so much for the war effort. They'd gone through 5 bond drives. And for a size of town like Hickory, that's saying quite a bit. So when this happened, it's just, well, this is the next thing we need to do. And polio never was the headline in the newspaper. It was always the war. So everybody had the war fully in their heads, that's what the effort was for, and then this just got added on.
As these cases spread in 1944, the orthopedic hospital in Gastonia took some patients. What was then called Charlotte Memorial Hospital took a lot of patients to the point where they couldn't handle patients anymore, which is what led to this development of this miracle in Hickory of building that hospital over just 2 days. Polio had been around for a long time. It's been around since the beginning of time. Had this area ever experienced anything like this, whether it was medically related or in some other way?
There was a smaller epidemic in 1935, but in that day, parents were told, take your kid home and isolate them from the rest of the family. Franklin Roosevelt really makes the difference here, because in 38, when he creates the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, he gives an opportunity for study, research, resources through the March of Dimes to be able for a national effort to come to Hickory and give us their expertise, and we followed along with that, give their expertise so that they could not only treat the patients, but they could study the disease.
The March of Dimes is something that people of a certain age remember, and you probably remember the little cards that were at countertops all over in stores where you put your dime in a little slot. I'm just curious, did that lead to the vaccines? Did it in any way help pay for the prevention of the spread?
Oh, yeah. They came in by the thousands, if not millions, to the White House every year starting in 1938, every year on FDR's birthday. That's when they celebrated, at the end of January. Okay. And that was when they had the drive.
So as someone who teaches epidemiology, Kimberly, at what point in 1944 was this deemed to be an epidemic?
Well, we look at the distribution of the outbreak, and so once it reaches a certain level, you know that there has to be more done. There were tons of researchers that were doing work. You mentioned Dr. Salk. There was also a Dr. Sabin in the Cincinnati area who were pouring in so much effort, so much time in order to try to find some solution to and contain the spread of the disease.
Can you compare it to COVID, what we just went through with COVID? There was so little known about polio at the time, and we knew nothing about COVID. We were washing our groceries, for crying out loud, for a while. So, I mean, was it similar?
I think there were a lot of similarities, because when you have this fear of the unknown, especially when you know that it can affect our most vulnerable people, our children, the elderly, you want to be able to do something. Even if you don't know everything about what to do medically, you want to do something. So you want to start isolating yourself or wear masks or avoiding certain areas because you don't know how this disease is going to affect you.
So how do public health officials, how do epidemiologists work when they don't, when there are so many unknowns, as opposed to if there was an outbreak of polio today, mm-hmm. we would know a lot more. So yes. How do you approach that?
You have to study the cases one by one as they come. Because even today in places like Afghanistan or Pakistan and some other countries where you might still have an endemic disease prevalence, you approach each case one by one. You try to find out who they have been in contact with and how it was transmitted.
Yeah.
Several people mentioned about like swimming holes and places where people were swimming, and those were potentially contaminated water that if someone else gets there, then they can orally consume the germ, the pathogen.
They didn't know exactly how, I don't think.
No, they didn't.
How it was spread. The people mentioned water, swimming pools were closed, obviously. The people thought flies might carry it. They thought it was carried airborne. They thought maybe saliva carried it. It is evidently transformed through fecal matter.
Mm-hmm. And it's highly contagious.
So how often, in what way does it most often spread, I guess is the question.
It's spread from person to person. So if
yeah, but
if,
how?
If there's if the pathogen, if the virus is found in water sources, and if it's somehow consumed, whether from a contaminated hand or some other means, then the virus is in your system, and because it could be asymptomatic for a long period of time, you could be carrying the virus and spreading it unknowingly, whether it's orally or, like I said, with changing a child's diaper, you could spread it and not even realize.
So were medical officials, were parents who were taking care of their kids at home because they were told to take them home and put a sign on the front door saying they were quarantining, were they in danger?
They could have potentially been in danger, yes.
Wow. The town of Hickory had, as you mentioned, I think only 6 cases that came from Hickory proper. But the surrounding area had 68 more at the very beginning. And so, as you said, this is the epicenter of that outbreak in 1944. But in 1944, Hickory was a much smaller place. It was 15,000 people. It had no hospital. And until this epidemic made them decide that they needed to open one and do it quickly, and they accomplished this in 54 hours. Who was involved, Richard, in that decision?
It was the county health director, Dr. H.C. Wims. It was the county health nurse, because she'd seen a lot of these cases, Frances Allen. And it was the local president of the chapter of the National Foundation, Dr. Gaither Hahn. They were the three that, when they got that call on Wednesday from Charlotte to say, we can accept no more patients, they kicked into action and said, we've got a camp over here for underprivileged youth. We've got a building. It was a WPA building. And we can use that for the hospital. And so Thursday morning, they pulled in a couple of architects, a husband and wife team, to redesign that whole campus and begin the process of conversion.
When did that happen? Because the first case presented in May of 1944. How quickly were the hospitals in Gastonia and Charlotte overwhelmed to the point where they had to do something here?
Well, that came the 21st of June.
Wow.
As the cases started to build, because most of them, and a couple of people who were, ended up at the Hickory, first went to Charlotte, and they were told to go home until the Hickory Hospital is functional.
So I don't know. I read about this yesterday. I'm not sure we could accomplish this today quite the way they did it, because it was a summer camp in operation, and they told the kids, you have 1 hour to get out.
Yeah. Go home.
To go home.
Yeah.
And they were gone. And then the work began. What had to be accomplished to convert that one building into a working hospital?
Well, you had to figure out who was going where. Where were the wards? And immediately they started building, because eventually they had like 14 other ward buildings for patients. I mean, Dan was in one of those, and they were. Was it 80 by 20, 60 by 20, I forget the number. But they built those. But they just started saying to people, come, help us. We need it. And they didn't know if anybody was going to show up, because with polio being that thing that they don't know about, it's possible that you could get it, take it home to your kids, and then you'd be in a, you know, in a world of hurt. But people did come, and they started bringing whatever they had to be able to help. It wasn't like a party atmosphere. When they started that morning, that Thursday morning, people were determined. They got down to work. The local, one of the local sawmills told its people, anybody that comes for wood, you give it to them, because they knew it was going to be for the polio effort. And you began to see them laying off streets, enhancing the telephone system, adding to the electricity, all this infrastructure that's going to make its own little town.
And over that first weekend, or the first 54 hours, they brought in spotlights so they could work 24 hours a day. They could light the place up at night. And this work went on long after that first building was converted.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
They built more buildings all through the summer, correct?
Yes. Into the fall, yeah.
How long was it operational?
It was operational till the 5th of March, when they decided, and by that point the epidemic had passed, you're back in the winter, right, so there's no cases, that Charlotte could handle the convalescence of those. I think there was like 87 patients still here, and they trucked them all, you know, had a convoy and trucked them all to Charlotte.
Why were the warm summer months, Kimberly, the months that seemed to be the time of year where there was real danger in polio appearing?
Well, lots of infectious diseases are temporal, so there might be variations during the year that people will be more susceptible. So think about in the summer months when you are swimming and you are doing more socializing, you are engaging with others who could be carrying the virus. It could increase your risk.
So Dan, I want you to go back in the Wayback Machine, the memory machine. These efforts were all reported in the local papers. It was reported.
Well,
on the
I'd like to throw in that the admission at the hospital was about a 4x12 tent down by the road with a sign on top that said admissions.
And you remembered this?
And that's where the patients came into the hospital.
Okay. This was all reported extensively in newspapers at the time and radio. I know that WHKY here in Hickory played a major role in getting people to come and help build this facility and donate to this facility. It caught the attention of Life magazine, and if you caught the attention of Life magazine in 1944, you were everywhere. It was like being on, there's nothing to compare Life magazine to today, I don't think. There was a film made of it, and Greer Garson was the host of the film telling people about this. Do you remember any of that, Dan?
I remember those. My father made a 30-minute color film that he, during the epidemic.
Yeah, let's talk about this, because your father documented this on film, and nobody had a camera back then. Why did your father have a camera?
He had a little 8mm camera.
But why? Who had cameras back then?
He had just gotten interested in photography.
Really?
And he made an 8mm film. It lasted about 30 minutes. He went out and bought him a little titling thing where he could put his camera in the thing and take a shot of a title, and put it all together. And he showed every treatment and everything that went on in the hospital for the patients and what went on. And about, I guess it was probably now 7-8 years ago, I had a copy of it out, and I called the National Foundation in New York and asked them about it, and they hadn't heard about it, so I sent them a copy. And he called me back, and he said he had set up all of his staff, and everybody had looked at that film, and no one had ever seen what went on at Hickory.
Wow.
Until that film.
This effort required construction. It required supplies, it required hospital beds and mattresses and linens and towels and washing machines, which were probably relatively rare at the time. Ditches had to be dug for sewage to be disposed of because we're bringing lots of people into this. I know that state prisoners were brought in to help in the construction. I think one of them, their term in prison expired while they were here. Am I right about this?
And they stayed.
And they stayed because they wanted to continue helping. But towns were involved. Merchants were involved. How many people were involved in this effort? This seems gargantuan to me.
Oh, it's huge. I don't think we know how many people because they didn't really document that. They were concerned about the event. And at times people would just bring things. Farmers would bring produce. And we worked out a really kind of interesting system as we went along. The hospital would announce to the radio station, we need fans or we need harmonicas. They need it to help build the patient's lungs. And they would broadcast that on WHKY, and people would bring those things to the Episcopal Church of the Ascension, and the pastor there, Reverend Stroop, would bring them to the hospital. And there was all kinds of things. There was all the, you got kids, so you need to give them something to do. So you had all of these things that they would announce they needed, and they'd show up there.
This required the, somebody said it required the complete cooperation of the entire community. And that's what happened.
Pretty much. I mean, there were a few people.
And beyond. My mother came up and took a room in Hickory and worked as a full-time volunteer the whole time I was there.
Did you ever talk to her about that? Because she was putting herself in danger.
Huh?
She was putting herself in danger.
Yeah.
Did she ever talk to you about that when you grew older?
Not really. And it was funny because she did not want to interfere with my... Apparently, I didn't realize at the time, but I think she did not want to interfere with my treatment. So I only saw her on Sunday afternoon when visiting hours came around.
Talk about that, too, because I understand that a lot of the kids were there. The parents were told to leave. So the kids were in these wards by themselves.
Right.
They're scared already because of what's happening to them physically, and now their parents aren't there, and they're in this strange place all by themselves. What was that like?
Well, you know, we were by age and sex. So, you know, I was in a room with, I don't know, 12, 14 little boys my age, and we made models and read books and played games, and, you know, we really had a lot going for us because we didn't have to go to school.
Well, it was summer. I want to hear more about that from you and what the treatments were like, because we didn't know anything, and I'm sure that some of the treatments were for naught,
right.
But they felt like they were doing the right thing. But I want to hear about that from you when we come back, and a little bit more about one of the other aspects of this effort, which for 1944 was way ahead of its time. We'll talk about that when we come back. We're coming to you from Lenoir Ryan University in the Belk Centrum Auditorium in front of a live audience with Richard Eller from Catawba Community College, Kimberly Price from Lenoir Ryan, and Dan Mowry, a survivor of the miracle of Hickory. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE, WFHE, and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're at the Lenoir Ryan University Belk Centrum Auditorium to talk about the miracle of Hickory, which happened in 1944, where they built an entire hospital in 54 hours to accommodate an outbreak of polio. Richard Eller is with us. He's an historian with the Catawba Community College, Catawba County Community College, Kimberly Price, or Catawba Valley Community College. Kimberly Price is with us, professor of public health at Lenoir Ryan University, and Dan Mowry, who is a survivor of the miracle of Hickory. I alluded to this just before the break. This was at a time in 1944 of racial integration. That did not matter.
Mm-mm.
In this effort. What do they say, Richard? That the next person in, black or white, got a bid.
Next bid, yes.
How do you explain that?
I think it's the severity of the emergency. And especially since when a lot of these patients came in, just about all of them, they were quarantined. So nobody outside the patients themselves and the folks who were, you know, the nurses and the doctors in the hospital really knew. I talked to one survivor who was at the hospital, and he said he was there when they opened up the ward and a mother came in and she found her son, who was white, next to an African-American boy, and she pitched a fit to the point that they had to begin to segregate.
To anybody of a certain age, I guess people in Hickory know this, but a lot of people don't know this, as I said at the very beginning of the program. As an historian, this was a significant event. It would be a significant event today. So as an historian, what does it say to you about us that we don't remember this, or this is not part of the zeitgeist, at least in this town?
I think it's easy to forget because you know, this is a terrible event, and you kind of want to put it behind you. But the resilience of these people to come here and contribute in so many different ways, putting themselves at danger, as you said, it really says something about what this community can do in times of an emergency.
But you also have said that being forgetful about this was in some ways purposeful. How so?
Well, after the fact, that whole hospital and all that they had built there was just abandoned, and then another 12 years later they tore it down, and then a couple of years after that the National Foundation sues the local guys, and you get into an argument over that sort of thing, and it just kind of falls apart from there. But at the point of emergency, the resilience of people to come here and contribute and volunteer is just phenomenal.
And of course, part of it was the fact that you became known because of all this publicity. Hickory became known as Polio City,
which and a is model for how to do it.
But just the fact that you were called Polio City, it seems to me that's not something you want to advertise very often.
Not at the time, but yeah. You got a lot of people after the fact, once it had passed and we saw the outpouring of support. They said Hickory became great for all time,
yeah,
because they weathered it.
I have that quote, which I'm going to read at the very end of the program. Dan, I want you to take me through this, because the way you framed your coming down with polio, contracting it, you seem rather nonchalant about it. Was it not scary for you, and particularly
well,
for your mom and dad?
Well, I didn't know what it was. It took a while before I knew what it was. And as a child, it doesn't scare you. I mean, I was 9, 10 years old. It scared my mother, I'm sure, but she didn't let me know it.
Okay. But there you are in this hospital. Your parents aren't with you very often. Some of the treatments... what were the treatments?
The treatments were largely hot packs. They would come in and decide what parts of the body were affected, legs, arms, what have you, and then they would cut you a set of materials. There would be a cloth like a triangle, and then there would be a plastic triangle, same size. There'd be another cloth triangle over that was usually wool. And they would put the bottom, the small triangle, in boiling water. And they'd take it out and run it through an old wringer washer. And they'd get it to your bed as fast as they could and put it on your leg and wrap the plastic around it and wrap the wool around it and leave it until it got cool and do it again.
And I've read that there are people who were in that situation with you who to this day are triggered by the smell of wet wool.
I've heard that. I have heard that.
Why, Kimberly, why does this disease affect people so differently? You have Dan here who can walk. You have others who were in an iron lung for the rest of their lives. They couldn't even breathe.
Yeah. It just depended on where it hit the nerves.
Right. So like we said before, many people are asymptomatic. Many people, maybe the a replication of the virus in their intestines did not it did not reach their spinal cord, so they were just having like abdominal illnesses. But to this day, poliomyelitis has no cure. There's no cure for it.
Well, that was my next question. What about the treatments? Are there different treatments, or are we still putting boiling hot wool on people's
limbs? Well, you treat the symptoms. Again, it's a viral illness, so you do treat the symptoms. You try to catch it early, but the key really is prevention, and we have the prevention for polio today, and that's with vaccinations. That has changed the game with the distribution of vaccines being effective throughout the world.
We have almost virtually eradicated this and other diseases, at least in the United States,
mm-hmm.
polio. And the danger, of course, and we are seeing some outbreaks right now. One person, I think, it was an unvaccinated adult who got it, and there are some kids who have gotten it recently, but it's not because of its being terribly prevalent here. It's because of international travel. It's coming in from other parts of the world. So here we have eradicated this disease because of vaccines, and yet we have vaccine skeptics and vaccine reluctance amongst us. And the number two person at the FDA has advocated that the FDA revoke approval for the polio vaccines. What is your reaction to that?
They're nutcases.
I'm so glad you're here.
They're nutcases.
Right. It's very concerning because we wouldn't have gotten this far without the mandatory vaccines across the world, without global cooperation. And it's like, now, why are we choosing to opt out? We're on the brink of eradicating it from the world.
But I want to put in one other piece that hadn't come up. A lot of a major reason for the worldwide abolition of polio was the Rotary Club.
Explain that.
They took it on as their mission to abolish polio worldwide. And they raised money from their chapters. They came up with whatever it took and set up the systems to get the vaccine in the backwoods countries. And they vaccinated all over the world.
These vaccines became available about 11 years after the outbreak here. They had been working on them since the early 50s, but they became available in 1955. The Salk vaccine, Dr. Jonas Salk. That came about in 1955 after he experimented on his own family and on people in the USSR, the Soviet Union, etc., not here. And this is a live vaccine, correct?
Mm-hmm.
In 1957.
Well, the live vaccine was the oral vaccine. The inactivated vaccine was the one that Salk did.
Okay.
Oral vaccine was Sabin.
So the inactivated vaccine was 1955. By 1957, annual cases dropped from 58,000 to 5,600. And by 1961, only 161 cases were reported. Then that other vaccine, the Sabin vaccine, that was the fun one because they put it on a sugar cube. You all remember, don't you? That was the only time I can ever remember going to the doctor and being happy about it. It was great. Was there any pushback at the time? Any concern by parents at the time? Because this is a brand new vaccine, and vaccines themselves were kind of a new idea in a way. Was there any pushback from those folks at the time? Or was this seen as savior?
Well, once you saw the reduction in the number of cases mm-hmm. from the previous vaccine, the new vaccine, which was given orally, it was a little bit easier to distribute, then I think many parents were eager to sign up for it. I had the privilege of graduating from the University of Cincinnati, so there's a lot of honoring of Dr. Sabin there, and there's a description of the Sunday Sabin initiative where people lined up from churches and preschools and places where they wanted their children to actually get this vaccine.
I want to mention that Jonas Salk, Dr. Jonas Salk, who invented the first vaccine, took no money. in exchange for this. Yeah. He could have been a billionaire. He took no money.
He was relentless. He really worked effectively as well as very rigorous way to make sure that everything is in place for his vaccine.
You teach about vaccines. Mm-hmm. You teach about their successes. You're on the radio. So tell people out there about vaccines and why they shouldn't be afraid of them, if you believe that, and help them to understand what these vaccines accomplish and the risks involved with regard to what they accomplish.
Okay, and I'll be fairly brief because one of the things that you often hear, and it's part of the misinformation that's being distributed, is that these are like new vaccines, they've never been tested, we don't know what's going to happen. But vaccines have been around for a long time, and there have been numerous studies to show the efficacy of the vaccines, the safety of the vaccines, and how in all cases, any side effects from any type of vaccine is far less concerning than the actual disease that it's preventing.
So a lot of people who are vaccine skeptics, deniers, just cautious about them, will tell you that they don't trust professionals, they don't trust the institutions that have guided this for a long time, that they have done their own research. And you're an academic, so doing research is your thing. So to help these people, where should they go to do their own research?
Well, if they have their own laboratory, yes, I can see that they're doing their research. But they don't. They're listening to people who are in it maybe for money, maybe for notoriety, but they're looking to people who they think are relatable, but unfortunately, they're misinformed. And being misinformed and spreading misinformation is a disservice, and it's taking the lives of people.
Dan, what would you say to people? Because you've had this disease most of your life. You're 90, you got it when you were 9. Yeah. You had peers that didn't fare as well as you did, perhaps. So what would you say to parents who are worried about vaccines, including the polio vaccine?
Quit listening to the Trump administration.
Period.
There's one piece of the facility, since that was here in Hickory, that hadn't been brought up, and I just think it needs to be told. The original building that was there was on sort of up on a hill, and there was a slope that came down, and there were, I think, five or six of those military buildings that were built.
Down from it, yeah.
Built like going down the hill. And I don't know those of you who remember World War II. The Army had buildings that were a wooden floor, a 4-foot wall all the way around, and a door at each end. And if you just saw it, that's all it would be sitting there. There's nothing over it. So they'd put that in place and put a tent over it. And they made wards out of those. We had 5 or 6 wards made out of those tents. And we spent the winter in them.
Oof.
And they weren't all that comfortable. They were drafty.
Yeah.
But they filled the need to do something quickly. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I forgot you. They were, I think that there's a pic, if you go to the museum here, the polio museum, I think there's a picture of it on the wall there, but I'm not sure. It was a long time since I've been there.
I wanted people to know that this effort, which was gargantuan, had a 97% success rate, which is remarkable. 454 patients, they lost only 12 children in all of that time, and they cut through mounds of red tape to make all of this happen. In 1945, Carol Hughes wrote about this effort in a magazine called Coronet, in which she said this: The full cost of Hickory's polio epidemic may never be known. The brave little city has taken a terrific financial beating without once regretting it. And the amazing fact remains that while the epidemic raged in full fury, the town of Hickory had only 6 cases of infantile paralysis within its limits, fewer than any other stricken area in the state. Yet it constructed a hospital open to all races and creeds and willingly took on itself the stigma of being known as Polio City. By that very sacrifice, she writes, Hickory became a great city for all time. Yes. We'll leave it at that. Richard Eller, professor of history and historian in residence at Catawba Valley Community College and the Historical Association of Catawba County, Kimberly Price with Lenoir Rhine University, and Dan Mowry, a survivor of the miracle of Hickory. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.